Good to see you tonight. Thank you for coming back out again. And we're in Exodus chapter 29. And before we look at this, I want to remind you that the first thing that people think of when they think of the book of Exodus is think, oh, you know, the story of the Exodus. And that's really all they really ever think about the book. But Moses gives us, I think, and this is just my opinion, so it's, you know, it's open to interpretation and debate, but I think that what Moses does is he includes in this book, after the Exodus, the events that he considers most pivotal to the future of the history of Israel. As the people come out of Egypt, go across the sea, go down to Sinai, and now, being encamped at Sinai, they get what I think is the startup stuff. Okay, and then as you get into Leviticus, Numbers, you get into the meat of the law itself. But these are the startup realities of the people of Israel. So that's why I'm taking my time working through it, because it's not, at first glance, you might just jump over this passage and go, okay, kill a bull and a couple of rams and get some, you know, unleavened bread and do something to the priests. But there's more to this. I think there's significance here. And that's why we're kind of taking our time with the tabernacle. You'll notice that the next lesson is construction of the tabernacle, part three. So we're going back to the construction of the tabernacle because Moses pulls out here a couple of lessons on the priests. And then that goes back to the tabernacle. Remember that what we're talking about here is really the beginning of the sacrificial system. Okay, this is the beginning of the sacrificial system. We're going to get a lot more detail of that when we get into the later books, Leviticus, etc. But here's where we get the establishment of the men who will be leading the people in the most significant religious function that they will do, which is to come to the temple and purchase atonement through these men who will be the instrument of that atonement. And on top of that, of course, now we can look at it, you know, 2,000 years removed from the New Testament, as we can say, these things have relevance for us in terms of our understanding of the New Testament. I've said countless numbers of times, you cannot understand the New Testament without understanding the Old. Without having an understanding of what's going on, particularly in chapters like this, you cannot understand the significance of the ministry of Christ. So here's where we are.
You said something that I've never heard anyone ever say.
What's that?
Purchase atonement.
Purchase atonement is what you do. Right. You bring an animal, you buy it.
I've never heard anyone ever put it that way, which makes Romans that.
Yeah, right.
I mean,
we've been bought with a price. There's a purchase.
You hear that, but in the Old Testament, you know, you had the sacrificial system. The sacrificial system there is there to purchase their atonement.
Correct.
For their sin.
Correct. And they're doing it through these men. Okay, so let's look at the details of the chapter, and what I'm going to try to do tonight is link these to Christ, okay? Because that's, I think, the most important lesson that comes out of chapter 29. If you really want to understand the person and work of Christ, you need to understand what's going on here. Okay, this consecration process, all right, where we're going to set aside the priest. Remember, consecration means to set aside someone to a unique and to a unique place, unique purpose. Consecrate is to separate, not just to separate one thing from another, but to separate unto a holy purpose. All right, so they're going to consecrate these priests, and they're going to do so using a bull, a couple of rams, some unleavened bread, some unleavened cakes, and some unleavened cakes smeared with oil, unleavened cakes. Okay, so you're going to use these various accoutrements to accomplish this. Now, the animals were to come without blemish, because the blemish would symbolize, of course, the fact that they were impure, they couldn't be offered to God, only the best could be offered. Now, as I pointed out last week, there's no such thing as an unblemished animal. Okay, you walk around in a herd of cattle, you won't find an unblemished animal. All animals have blemishes by virtue of being on earth. But the idea is to find the best of your flock, the best of your herd, that which is the best to you. Which, by the way, if you were selling it, would fetch the best price. Okay, so you're offering unto God the very best that you have. All right, so they were to come with their perfection, and that would, of course, be symbolic of their holiness, symbolic of their of what the priests were doing in offering to God that which would purchase atonement. The bread, of course, was to be made without yeast. The cakes were to be made without yeast because yeast represents sin. Leaven represents sin in the scriptures. And so God says, I want no yeast. I don't want any leaven to be used in these accoutrements, because it's going to be symbolic of what the priests are going to be doing. The priests are going to be taking these animals that you're offering, and they're going to be bringing them to the Lord in order to provide atonement for the sins of the people. The sin it needs to be removed, all right? So we take the sin out by removing the yeast from the bread. That's symbolizing something for the priest. It's a reminder to the priest then from then on. What you're doing, O priest, is standing before the people and bringing their sin to God so that it can be atoned for and done away with, okay? Now, all of this is figurative of the perfection of Christ. The lack of sin in him, him being an unblemished sacrifice, that's all pointing us forward to Christ, okay? So we'll be moving in that direction. Now, you'll notice that there's events that are to take place here, starting in verse 4. Bring Aaron and his sons, wash them with water, put the garments on them, set the turban on their head, take the anointing oil and pour it on his head and anoint him, bring his sons and do the same to them. And then it says in verse 9, and the priesthood shall be theirs by a statute forever. All right, that's a key phrase. The act of clothing and anointing these priests would be symbolic of a permanent transfer of responsibility. A permanent transfer of responsibility. When they placed these robes on these priests, the priest would be literally taking on the office of the priest. Up to this point, Aaron was just a man. Right? Just a guy. Just another guy like any other. He happened to be a Levite, but he was just a guy. But now, by taking these clothings upon himself and receiving the anointing, he's become a priest. And this title stays with him for the rest of his life. As we talked about last week, in Catholic circles, when a man becomes a priest, when he is ordained to the office of priesthood, he can never lose that title. He can be defrocked in the sense that he can be removed from active duty in a church and lose the congregation and be banished, but he cannot lose the title. And same is going on here. The priest is being established. This is a forever reality. There's no resignation from the priesthood. By the way, in case you didn't know it, there's no resignation from the papacy either. The Pope cannot resign. Okay, so Benedict never really resigned. He can't lose his office of Pope. What they had to do was they had to make a category for a man who hadn't done this in 800 years, which is to step aside into a Pope emeritus position. Okay, so the idea of taking on the priesthood is once you take it on, once you're consecrated, once you're robed, this is what you are. Now, this would transfer also to Aaron's sons. The part of the ordination process for Aaron is then followed up by the ordination process of his sons. The implication of that being that this will now transfer through the line of the Levites from Aaron to his offspring forever. So the priesthood is being established here by a consecration that would pass automatically to the sons of Aaron. All right. Now, one of the first symbolisms and parallels here comes to Christ, because just as Christ was established into his office as a priest, that priesthood stands by forever. In Hebrews chapter 5 and Hebrews chapter 7, it speaks of this. I know we looked at this last week, but there were some of you who weren't here, so let's look at it again. Hebrews chapter 5, verse 6. Actually, back to verse 5. So also Christ did not exalt himself to be made a high priest, but was appointed by him who said to him, "You are my son, today I have begotten you." Okay, so who says that?
The Father.
The Father says that. The Father says, "You are my son." Okay, so we know who it is. "Today I have begotten you. I have established you into this role. I have birthed you," is another way of saying this, into this role. But now notice verse 6. As he also says in another place, "You are a priest forever." Now he adds a qualifier, "after the order of Melchizedek." And if you go to 7:17, it says, "For it is witnessed of him, you are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek." Notice the writer repeats the same verse twice. All right. What he's doing is he's making a point. And here's the point. Jesus cannot be qualified tribally as a priest. He's not from the tribe of Levi. So he can never be a priest in the Judaic sense of the word. He's not a Levite. It cannot transfer to him. But yet he is a priest, but from a very different line. The line that he's a priest from is a line that predates Abraham, predates the Levites. It is a priesthood that this writer in Hebrews thinks is greater than the line of the Levites, because he makes this argument in Hebrews. There was a man that Abraham went to and offered a tithe to after he had gone out and slayed the kings in the valley. Abraham comes back with all the spoil that he had collected, and he meets this king of Salem, this Melchizedek, and he offers a tithe to him. He gives a portion of what he had earned to this Melchizedek. By doing so, he is offering a tithe not only on his own behalf, but on behalf of all of his descendants. Because where are his descendants at the point he offers the sacrifice?
In him.
They're in his loins. Now, we don't think like this as Americans in this culture, but Jews do, in particularly in ancient cultures. What you have as a father and what you do as a father passes down to the generations after you. There's a sense in which what you do passes down. This is why, by the way, the idea of original guilt is a concept that the New Testament writers understand. What Adam did passes down to the generations that followed him. So the guilt that he has as a man who sinned passes down to every generation of those who follow after him. So Jesus, this writer says, is coming from the line of a man who offered a tithe to a priest while the Levites are still in him, which implies that those Levites were offering a sacrifice or a tithe to this Melchizedek, which makes him a far greater priest than Aaron. Aaron, the first of the priests that would be in the line of the Israelites, but Aaron was in Abraham when Abraham offered it, and that priesthood is a far greater priesthood. And so the writer of Hebrews says this Jesus is a priest, but not of the Levitical line. He's a priest of a permanent line. That's even better. And he goes on to point out a number of other realities related to the priesthood of Jesus in this. And so this point that the writer is making is that this consecration of Aaron is permanent. The parallel is that the consecration of Christ to his role by the Father as a priest is forever. It is a permanent priesthood. Jesus takes on the role of a priest when he enters into this world. He is anointed by the Father. Now, I contended that the anointing of the Father to this role occurs in eternity past. When the Father says to the Son, "Today I have begotten you," that's a picture of eternity past. "Today I have begotten you, therefore you have become my son. And because you have become my son, I am anointing you, setting you aside, consecrating you to this role." And so when the eternal Son of God was begotten from the Father, the result of that is he became a priest, and that priesthood extends forever. So this Christ is still our priest. He is still acting in the office of the great high priest, and he is still standing before the Father as the one who is making a mediation for those who belong to him. Okay. So just as Aaron's priesthood is permanent, so is Christ's. Okay. Now we go to the next point. He is anointed with oil, right? See it in verse 7. You see it also, by the way, in 1 Samuel 6:13, because the process of taking oil was to pour it over the head of either a priest or a king. Because there is a sense of consecration involved in setting aside a king as well, because you're setting him aside to a holy purpose. A priest, of course, is being set aside to the holy office of providing atonement for a people. A king is being set aside for the purpose of acting as the representative of God amongst the people. You remember last week we talked a little bit about this idea of a theocratic monarchy. That's maybe not a word you've ever heard before, but it's one you should know. A theocratic monarchy is a monarchy in which the head of the kingdom is not a king unto himself, but rather is simply representing the King of Kings, the Lord himself. So in Israel, the theocracy, the original pure theocracy during the days of the judges, was replaced by what God expected there to be a theocratic monarchy, where the king would not be serving at his own behest, but would be serving as the representative of God. Saul fails as the first great king because he takes on a role of this is what I want. I know God has told me to do something specific, but I'm not going to do that. I want to do something else. And then when God confronts him about it, what does he do? He makes excuses. Okay. And so God says, fine, you can't have this anymore because you're not obviously not representing me. You're representing yourself. So along comes David. Now, David falls into sin, and yet God still calls him a man after my own heart. Why? Is it because he's perfect? No. It's because he's still doing his work as a king, saying, I wish to follow what it is that God would have me to lead this nation. Even when David, you remember, goes to the Lord after he's finished all of his conquest work, Jerusalem has been established as the capital, and he goes to God and says, I want to build you a temple. And God says, no. David didn't pitch a fit, did he? No. He said, okay, if that's what you want, that's what you have. I get the honor, by the way, and this is David's thinking, remember that Jewish thinking, I get the honor of my son building the tabernacle. See, in American culture, we wouldn't think like that. But in ancient Jewish, they would say, yes, yes, oh, my son gets to build it. Oh, that's a great honor to me, okay? So he's doing the work of, David is, of doing the work of following the Lord. He's a theocratic monarch. Okay, so the oil is the idea of setting aside someone to a role to act on behalf of either God or men. A king acts on behalf of God. Priests act on behalf of men. But either way, they're being set aside to a role to the Lord. Okay, so that's what this oil is doing as they are being anointed. Okay, Jesus is anointed in his role before eternity past of where he is begotten of the Father and anointed to this. Now, oil is an important metaphor in the Bible. And notice that word, metaphor. Mm-hmm. It means something. It represents something. And I had you look in question 2b at a number of symbolisms from various places. For example, in Psalm 23, it's oil representing the protection and security of the Lord. We read that Psalm this morning, didn't we, some people? Mm-hmm. Right? He anointeth my head with oil, my cup overflows. The idea of security, the idea of protection, assurance, that sort of thing. In Micah 6:15, it represents the natural provision of God, the blessings that come from obedience and loyalty to the Lord. In Luke 7, the oil represents the love of God that procures forgiveness. The anointing of the Lord himself is the one who is able to forgive, as it's seen in that passage. And then in James 5, we see oil representing the healing power of God administered through his agents to the sick. It is often noted that oil is representative of one of the manifestations of the third person of the Trinity. Just as the third person of the Trinity comes as wind or a dove or fire, water, also oil. And that would make sense here, right? The Spirit of God coming upon Aaron to help him to do the work that he's doing, to set him aside unto a specific role. So that would make sense. Okay. Now, as I said, going back to something I said earlier, to ordain someone. Very similar word to consecrate, by the way, so they're synonyms for all practical purposes. To ordain someone is to invest them with a ministerial or sacerdotal function, meaning giving them some responsibility in terms of religious importance, or to confer upon them a holy office. Now, in the New Testament, when we ordain, what we do is we set apart someone to the office of preaching, typically. Typically, we ordain preachers to the role. I was ordained by Hebron Baptist Church in August of 2001. They laid their hands on me. I went through an ordination process, and the church then agreed that they had seen the giftings and callings, and so they laid their hands on me and set me apart. Deb's uncle preached one of my ordination sermons, and a friend of ours from Shades Mountain preached the other, who was a child of one of the families in the church. According to 1 Timothy 3, of course, elders are to be ordained, set apart, lay hands upon them and set them apart to this office, because it's a special office, particularly of preaching and teaching and ministry to others. Timothy, you remember, according to chapter 4, verse 14, 1 Timothy 4, was ordained to the preaching office when the elders of the church laid hands on him, set him apart to that office. So there's precedent for this idea of laying hands upon some. We debated last week about whether or not we should ordain deacons to the office or not. There have been some outliers who don't think it's necessary to ordain deacons because they don't hold the function of teaching. But as Baptists, historically, we have believed that the office is an office established as one of the two outlined in Scripture and therefore should be ordained. It should be a specific setting aside. Now, we're not going to put deacons through anywhere near the same level of scrutiny that we would an elder, because we don't perceive the New Testament to teach that that deacons are teaching, that teachers. I mean, certainly could be. They could be gifted and called to that, obviously. But we don't see the office itself primarily as one of teaching. Notice there's no mention of teaching in the qualifications in 1 Timothy 3. So we don't do the level of scrutiny where we're looking for some specific sense in which the person is theologically sound enough to be able to do that kind of teaching, and we're confident that he can do so. We would do that kind of scrutiny for an elder for the obvious reasons. There's significance in there. It's not to say that the office of deacon is less important. I'm not saying that. I'm saying the office of deacon is a very important role, and the elders rely upon the deacons in a great way to accomplish what needs to be accomplished in order for the elders to focus where they focus their attention, right? Acts 6. Okay. And by the way, just as an aside, it's just a rabbit trail for a second. When I came here to interview, and I sat down on Saturday with the deacons. Were you there? You remember that? Remember that?
Okay. Oh, yeah.
I walked out of that meeting, and I said to my wife in the car, I said, you know what? In about 90% of American Baptist churches, those men would be elders. Mm. Because the level of training and learning and the discussion that we had, which was quite bizarre, because it was like an hour or two of theological dialogue, you know, really no discussion about changing light bulbs, which is kind of what I was expecting, you know, are you going to change light bulbs or are we going to do that, you know, sort of thing. That's what I expected, because that's your typical Baptist church, right? But not here. So I say that to your praise. So, all right. So in other words, the process of ordination is to set aside the priest to what was expected of them. And by the way, the ordination process is also in reverse. It is also a time for the congregation to say, this is what we expect, and this is what we will do. So when the congregation is observing the ordination of an elder or a deacon, the congregation is standing up and saying, yes, we are in favor of that. And by the way, as Baptists, historically, that has been an important point. Remember, Baptists have always been congregational in their approach to the church life. And so they look upon themselves, the congregation, as the final authority of matters of polity, and rightly so. The responsibility doesn't end with the elders. The responsibility ends with the people of God sitting in the pews that have been set aside to the membership of the church. Therefore, when the elders bring a man for eldership or bring a man for the office of deacon, the congregation is saying yay or nay to that, and we're wanting. So they're looking, observing, and praying along and saying, yep, we're expecting Roger to do his job. And if he doesn't do his job, then those people are going to be after you. Now, very often they're going to come and complain to us, but, you know, that's neither here nor there. Okay, so with all of that as pretext, then let's talk about the text itself. Okay, 10 to 34 describes the process of this ordination. Okay, take the bull, kill it before the entrance of the tent of meeting at the tabernacle, right? Take some of the blood, put it on the horns of the altar, take the rest of the blood, spill it out around the outside of the altar. Take the internal organs of the bull then, burn them on the altar, and then take the rest of the animal and burn it outside the camp. All right? So take the first animal and take some of its blood and pour it out. Okay. Take then one of the rams, kill it, take its blood and throw it against the altar itself, and then burn the entire animal on top of the altar. Okay? The second ram was called the ram of ordination. Now, I am convinced that the first two rams are preparatory. The first two animals are preparatory. They represent to me, I can't prove this from the text, but they represent to me the idea of what these priests are going to be doing over the long term. It's sort of like a picture. Okay, guys, stand here for a second. Watch what we do. And this is going to be what you're going to be doing. Killing animals, shedding their blood, taking it, pouring it out of the altar. The altar being the focal point of where this was going to take place. The altar, of course, representing taking that up before the Lord, right? You burn it there on the altar so that the aroma goes up to God. He smells the odor of that burning. And so it's a sweet aroma in his nostrils. It provides the satisfaction that he's looking for. But the blood, of course, representing the atonement, throw it at the altar. So it's like, okay, God, we're throwing this blood for you. Use this as the atonement. All right. So I think the first two animals are sort of preparatory in that sense. When you get to the third one, then you come to the ram of ordination. Okay. So you get this. It's a bit more symbolic. Okay, so take this one, kill it, take some of its blood, and put it on the tip of the priest's right ear, their right thumb, and the great toe of their right foot. Okay, so put a little here on the ear, put a little here on their thumb, and put a little ear on the toe of their foot. Okay, then take the rest of the blood, throw it against the altar. Now, the little blood here and here, and down on the foot, is representing of we are putting you, priest, into a position where you're going to be the one shedding blood, making atonement for the people. You're being set aside to this job. That's what I think it is. I think it's the idea of a little bit here and a little bit here and a little bit here to say, guess what? You are now, pun intended, right with God. Okay? So we're going to put you in a position now where you're going to be the one to do this. So this is serious business. So you're going to get a little bit here and a little bit here and a little bit down here. Okay. The priests then are to take the entrails of the ram and they are to wave it before the Lord. So they're going to have a handful of liver and kidneys and stomach and intestines and whatever else. And they're going to take that and they're going to wave it before the Lord. Okay. And they're going to wave it like this before God. Okay. And there's wave offerings in the Old Testament and in the law later on. Okay. And they're going to hold also one loaf of bread, one cake of bread, the wafer, the stuff before. Okay. So they're going to wave this stuff before God. And then they're just going to throw it on the altar and burn it. Okay. The idea of this waving will... I have a question about that later. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll come back to that later. Okay. So, they would then take the breast of the ram, and they would wave it again before the Lord. And then, after that, they would boil the remaining flesh of that ordination ram and eat it in front of the tabernacle. They would boil it and eat it. Now, these guys are wrinkling their nose down here because they're looking at boiled ram. It doesn't sound all that tasty, but
that's what I call a heave offering.
You want to heat it up. Yeah. It's a heave offering. Well, it's amazing what kind of broth you can make out of a boiled ram, though. Okay, so I don't really know, but the idea isn't for the taste of it. The idea is they are. There's two things going on here. One is you are going to eat this. It's going to represent the fact that you're all in on this. Okay. You're now a priest. This is all in. But remember, in the future, the Levitical priests would be getting their food from the sacrifices that would be brought and they would eat some of it because that's where they would get their meat from. Remember, they didn't own land, so they couldn't graze herds. They were completely reliant upon the people to bring the sacrifices. And so the meat would come to them from the animals that they would be in. God would give them a provision as a part of that. So it's really a symbolism like, okay, yeah, I'm all in on this.
And it would be the good stuff, too.
And they would get the good stuff eventually, right. So at this point... the idea is here's the process. Kill the bull, do the things to it. Kill the ram, do the things to it. And then that second ram becomes, okay, Aaron, now you are being set aside right here to this particular office. And you will notice it says in verses 10, 15, and 19 that they lay their hands on the animals before they kill them. They lay their hands on there. Now, again, notice the parallel to laying on of hands, right? In ordination, what do? We lay hands on the individual. What are we doing when we lay hands on somebody? The laying on of hands is symbolic of transferring something to them. So when we lay hands on a person for the purpose of establishing an office, we're transferring the authority of that office into that individual. So when we ordain an elder, the other elders stand and they transfer the authority that they possess to this man. So that he now possesses the authority to act as an elder. Same with the deacon. Lay hands on him. We're transferring the authority to act as a deacon. The church is transferring the authority to these men. In this case, by putting their hands on the object, what they're doing is they're symbolically transferring their own sin to the animal so that it can be killed and they then become worthy to take on the office. Okay, now, there's nobody worthy to truly act as a priest ever, except, of course, for Christ himself. But there's really no human that's able to do this. So what this is doing is it's symbolic of God saying, okay, I'm going to accept you as a priest because we have symbolically transferred your unworthiness to the animals. We'll then sacrifice the animals, eliminating this unworthiness and making you fit to serve the living God. Okay? So we'll transfer your unworthiness, your sinfulness to the animal. Now you are authorized to take up the role. But it also has the reverse effect in that it's symbolic of the sin of the priest that needed to be atoned before they could enter into the sacred role. So we're transferring something from them and something to them simultaneously, if you will, through this process. Okay, laying on of hands is transferring something to this, to the office holder. And we're throwing away your unworthiness. And we're transferring something to you at the same time. So you were unworthy, now you're worthy. Because we're giving to you a worthiness. And so that's what the laying on of hands is designed to do. Okay. Some of the blood, as I said, is put on Aaron and his sons for the purpose of atonement. They needed the atonement, but they also needed the blood to be sprinkled on them in order that they might be covered and protected as they went about the work that they did. They're going to sprinkle the blood on the mercy seat, so they're going to be covered by blood just like anybody else. So the blood part is easy for us to figure out. That's obvious, right? Now, remember that waving thing we were talking about before? Okay, so they wave it before the Lord. Now, if you look in the Old Testament, what you discover is wave offerings are otherwise known as peace offerings. In fact, it says that in this text somewhere, and I don't remember where. But the idea of a wave offering is very much the idea of take the animal's parts and wave it before God as a form of surrender. It's like waving a white flag. It's the idea of I'm waving something before the Lord. So he's taking the entrails of the animal and the cakes without leaven in them, right? And waving them before the Lord and saying, Lord, I don't deserve your mercy, I don't deserve this role, I don't deserve to be a mediator, I'm unworthy to do so. I've laid my hands on the animal, but I'm coming before you, the one true and living God, and I'm offering myself, I'm surrendering myself to you. That's what they're doing. The priests are waving these parts before God and burning them on the altar as a peace offering, a surrendering. Now, it's also a food offering, which complicates it a bit, but it doesn't really change the original intention. We're making peace with God. And, by the way, that's what priests really do, right? Isn't that their job? Make peace with God. You've got a bunch of sinful people that deserve the wrath of God. God ought to come down and destroy. But rather, the person comes, he takes an animal, he gives it to the priest, and the priest waves it before the Lord and says, peace, surrender, we give up. You're right. Your law is good. We admit it. It's the idea of a wave offering. So it's a surrender, okay? So all of these things, killing the animals, boiling the flesh, putting some blood on the altar, putting some blood on the priest, waving the various parts in front of God, all the stuff is supposed to take how long? 7 days to accomplish. And they're supposed to offer a bull on every one of those 7 days, okay? Every one of those 7 days, they're going to go through this process. So they're going to be doing this. Now, I'm convinced that the process itself does two things. Number one, it sets aside the altar to be a place that is special. Okay. Sets aside the altar as a place. You throw the blood in the altar. Why? To cover it. It gives a covering over the altar so that the altar becomes a place that's considered holy unto the Lord. And then it sets aside the priests to the office of making atonement on behalf of the people. So the length of the ceremony communicates the significance of this, and particularly how seriously God takes the issue of sin. Okay? The whole point of a 7-day process to set these men aside to the priesthood clearly establishes how important the office is, how important the altar is, how important the sacrifices are, and to wrap it all up, how important God thinks sin is. This is not light. This is not an instantaneous thing that God is setting up here. It's not to be treated lightly. We want to plant the idea of holiness in the mind of Israel, and particularly in the mind of the priests, firmly. So they know. This is not a light office. Not everybody can do this. You're not just going to set aside Joe Blow over here, who's a member of the tribe of Reuben, and just, you know, when we need a substitute priest, we'll just go get him because he likes to do it, and he'll just, you know, come and do it. No. No, no, no. This is serious business. There's a particular group of people that God has set aside. He will accept according to his particular purpose, who and how and when and where all of this is going to be done. Now, God takes this stuff seriously. And so he puts this process like this. And so according to verses 37 to 41, then, as you get to the end of the chapter, you see what they're doing is they're consecrating the altar itself by two offerings. A morning offering of a year-old lamb and a tenth measure of fine flour mingled with a fourth of a hin of beaten oil and a fourth of a hin of wine as a drink offering, and then an evening offering of the same. They're going to do it twice a day. And they're going to do this into perpetuity. It's going to continue day after day, year after year, where the altar itself is going to be consecrated. This is a place where I am going to meet with you and your sin is going to be atoned for, and the people of Israel are to take that seriously. Now, you remember that altar was built to be mobile. Remember? It was designed that they could fill it up with stuff and carry it and then set it down and go through the process all over again. So that's part of the reason why it's being done again and again and again, because it's going to be constantly moving. And so as it's moving, they would set it down again. Guess what? Consecrate it again. Okay, this is the place where God is going to come and our sins are going to be forgiven. If you think about it for a moment, all of this is designed as the way by which the people of Israel relate to Yahweh. Right? God comes to them and says, you're going to be my people. I'm going to be your God. Okay? I brought you out of Egypt. I brought you across the sea. I brought you down here to Sinai. I met with you. I'm giving you a law. I've given you a law. But that relationship continues, and this is how it continues. God says, I am holy. Therefore, be holy. As we talked about this morning, the middle of the holiness code, that statement is found. This is the same idea. This is a place where holiness is generated. This is a place where you are reestablished with me, not as a people who have kept some rules, but as a people who are ontologically mine. You belong to me. And so you're going to go through this process, not because you're following rules, but you're going through this process because you are mine. And we have a relationship. Don't think of this lightly, is the idea. I mean, Aaron is standing there with these robes on, and they've been throwing blood at the altar, and they put blood on him, and they're sacrificing bull after bull after bull, day after day for 7 days. The message is, Aaron, you are about to do a significant work here. You are holding these people fast in their relationship with the Creator. That's your job. And so you're going to be the one responsible for their holiness, bringing them and reestablishing their relationship when they sin. So that I, this is God speaking, I, as a holy God, can have relationship with them. You see the seriousness of this? This is not designed to be willy-nilly. This is designed to be something very specially put. Again, as I said at the beginning, it's why I think Moses puts it here in Exodus, immediately after, highlights this, immediately after the giving of the law on Sinai. Because it becomes, almost immediately, the way by which the people keep their relationship with the living God. That's key, right? That is key. And so they would have to be doing these sacrifices day after day. Now, it is from there that we can draw then the parallels to Christ. Okay? There's a lot of parallels that we can draw from the consecration of these priests over to Jesus. But let's just think about Jesus as a priest. Okay? A priest's job, first, is to bring the people to a place of holiness. So the ultimate high priest comes and he establishes a people in holiness. How does he do that? He goes to a cross. He pays for their sin. as a perfect lamb without spot or blemish. He goes to a cross. He pays for the price. He takes that blood into the presence of his Father. He offers it on behalf of his people. And the Father accepts that sacrifice. And what happens to the people that belong to this Christ? They're made holy. Okay? They're made holy. Justification by faith isn't just some side effect of the gospel. Justification by faith is the very essence of what it is that God purposed through his Son. That those who will believe in the Son, those who will, by virtue of their new heart, will believe in the Son, are made ontologically holy in the sight of God. These priests are unfortunately going to have to do this day after day after day, year after year after year, to keep trying to make holiness in the people and keep establishing it. But the ultimate high priest comes, and what does he do? He comes and creates the condition of holiness. And where does he get that holiness from? He gets it from his own life lived. I've said, how many times have I said this? That the life of Christ is as important as the death of Christ. Mm-hmm. What he did in that earthly life of living without sin, coming as a man and living without sin, was to create the righteousness that we could receive. This is not just a righteousness that God just pulls off the shelf somewhere in heaven and gives to us. It's a righteousness earned by the Son of God, who walked around on planet Earth for 30-some years, keeping the law of God perfectly, without sin, without concupiscence in the flesh, who did all that the Father demanded of him to do. And so when he went to the cross, he can say to the Father, listen, I lived righteously, and I lived righteously on behalf of him and her and him and her. And I died for their sin to provide atonement. So you accept from me my blood, and then you give to them my righteousness, holiness. So we are made holy in the sight of this God. Now, only the perfect high priest can accomplish that. These high priests could never do it. Okay. Another parallel here, of course, is the parallel of the fact that the priests of the Old Testament were replaceable. And they had to be. You know why? Because they kept dying. So their sons had to take it on and carry it on. But the difference is that we have a high priest who does not need to be replaced. He's been resurrected. Notice the connection of resurrection here. He's been resurrected, so he sits at the right hand of his Father making this intercession on behalf of a people permanently. We don't need another high priest. And we certainly don't need one on earth, contrary to our Catholic friends who insist that you have to have a mediator on earth. No, we don't. We have a mediator in heaven who sits at the Father's right hand and accomplishes something on behalf of his people. Okay. But here's the other thing. And this is the part that has always bothered me about so much of the teaching of evangelical churches, particularly Baptist churches. Listen. In the Old Testament, the priests never really accomplished the job, did they? I mean, they never really provided a perfect atonement. I mean, if they had, they wouldn't have to do it again. Because if it was perfect, it wouldn't have to be repeated. So when they walked in with an animal and sacrificed it, they were purchasing an atonement on behalf of their people. But it wasn't a perfect atonement, and it didn't create a permanent condition. But the ultimate high priest who comes, what does he do? He creates a permanent atonement. One that doesn't have to be repeated. One that doesn't have to be... One that is guaranteed to accomplish what it was supposed to accomplish. Now, here's where the problem lies. The synergist says, Christ came down from the Father and died in a general sort of way for a people. All people. Everywhere. He went to the cross. He made atonement for the whole world. I mean, don't they often quote the passage, right? He died for the whole world. For God so loved the world, right? God desires people everywhere to be saved. They quote all these verses and they say, well, that proves that when Jesus came down, he went to the cross, he died, and he made a potential atonement. Because you see, you and I have to finish it. We have to believe, which makes it now effective. It's not effective for you if you didn't believe it. Although it would have been enough to accomplish it for you. But he doesn't actually create anything for you. In reality, the synergist is admitting that Christ didn't actually accomplish anything at the cross. The accomplishment didn't come till 2,000 years later when you were born, heard the gospel preached, and responded in some way, and that's what produced the effect. So Jesus went to the cross and made a possible atonement. No. See, the priests made a possible atonement. They made it possible for you to be atoned. And God accepted their work. He didn't destroy the Israelites when they sinned. He accepted their atonement. It wasn't a perfect atonement, and it didn't provide a permanence, but he accepted it. Why? Because he was looking forward to the eventual high priest who would come and solve, finally, for his people, the actual atonement that he had established in the decree with the Son in eternity past. This was just symbolic, pointing forward to the one who would eventually come and do what those priests were not able to do. So we know, we understand from the New Testament, particularly from Jesus' own words, that he didn't come to potentially save you. He actually saved you. He actually produced atonement for you. He sat down at the right hand of his Father and said, "This one belongs to me. And there's nothing that can take this one out of my hand because I have made a permanent, absolute, final, complete, and utterly sufficient atonement for him." It's done. It's done. You see, if you don't have that view of the atonement, then you really don't believe in a substitutionary atonement. He didn't substitute for you. He did something which you can apply to yourself. But it's not a substitution. He didn't take your place. Because if he took your place, what does that imply?
A worthless.
No, if he took your place, you will be saved. There's no other possibility. So if Christ came to the cross and died for everybody in just some sort of generic fashion, he wasn't substituting for anybody. He was simply providing an atonement that you can then apply. And you can call it substitutionary because he did something that you can apply. But it's not a true substitutionary atonement. It's kind of an atonement, but he's not really taking your place. Look, the real atonement is this. The Father and the Son agreed in eternity past that the Son would be a priest on behalf of a people. And the Father gave a people to him and said, "These are the people. These are my chosen ones. I'm giving my grace to these individuals. I've set them aside by choice, every one of them, and I've given them to you. Now you go and you live under the law perfectly to make their righteousness, and then you go to the cross and you die in their place, knowing all of their names when you die because you know them. And then when you rise from the dead, you will sit here at my right hand making intercession for them, and they will never, ever be lost. They will belong to me forever. And that intercession will continue forever." That's the true view of the priesthood that's in picture here. These men are being set aside to an office. And yes, it's permanent, but it's not really permanent because Aaron's going to die, right? And it will provide atonement, but not really, because yes, the people got to come and offer another bull the next day and the next and the next. And even when God accepts the atonement, it isn't really a perfect atonement. It doesn't absolutely create their absolute perfection, does it? It's not a permanent reality for them in that sense. But our priest has come. The great high priest has come. The priest that the writer of Hebrews talks about. I really wish we could get some sinner just to actually read the book of Hebrews. You might actually understand something about the substitutionary nature of the work of Christ. But what he's arguing is there is a priest who comes from a greater line of priests, okay, not the Levitical priesthood, a priesthood that predates that. And I would argue it predates even Melchizedek. It goes all the way back to eternity past, okay? But here's Melchizedek who shows up on the scene to prove it, okay? He comes then, he enters into the world, he enters in as one of us, so he becomes as a man, so he takes on the mantle of humanity. Just like the priests were human, he comes as the human, but he comes as the great high priest in that he's able to go into the very presence of God where the priests were not allowed to go, really. I mean, once a year is not really into the presence of God, right? That's barely sneaking in, sneaking out. But our priest has gone into the presence of God. He's gone in with his own blood, a perfect sacrifice. He's gone into the perfect tabernacle as the perfect tabernacle, right? And he has offered a sacrifice that will produce the results, guaranteed. Not because of something we've done, but because of what the Father has decreed to happen from eternity past. I will accept this sacrifice on behalf of this people, and it will never be turned away. This is why Jesus can make that claim he does in John 6. Right? All that the Father gives me will come to me, and I will lose nothing of all that the Father has given me. And this is the important phrase, and I will raise it up on the last day. Jesus already knows who he's raising up, because he knows the people that he's raising up. The synergist can make no such claim upon the work of Christ, really. And in many ways, the synergist is simply falling back to an Old Testament system of priesthood, unfortunately, not really understanding the substitutionary work. So this little consecration effort here in Exodus 29 is pointing us somewhere, right? It's pointing us to the great priest who will come, who is set aside, not by human hands, but by the Father, begotten of the Father in eternity past, to a role of being a priest, anointed to that role by the Father, established in the world as a man on a cross with a sacrifice that's perfect. Again, you can't understand the work of Christ unless you understand the Old Testament, unless you see what's going on here, unless you understand what these priests are doing and why they're doing it and what's going on amongst the people. God takes this stuff pretty seriously, doesn't he? So serious that he sends his own son to accomplish it. No man can do what God requires to be done. Now, isn't that good news? That's good news, man. That is the best of news. My sinfulness very often leads me to the place of thinking, well, all right, God must once again be displeased with me. And, you know, and I've used this illustration before. It's almost as like Jesus stands up and goes, wait, that one's mine. As though the Father needs to be reminded. I know from a human point of view, that's kind of the way I look at it. But the good news here is that those who have been born of the Spirit of Christ, we have something to actually say about ourselves that we ought to say more often. That was my point this morning. Mm-hmm. You are holy in the sight of this God, not because you made yourself holy, but because Christ made you holy. He went to the cross and he created a holiness that you could never have created, and he robed you with a righteousness you could never have created for yourself. So stop thinking that your individual moments of failure and moments of success in the course of your life are what makes you right with God. They're not. We have to stop thinking like that. We have to start thinking of, I am atoned by Christ. That's who I am. And so when the devil walks up and says, hey, change these stones into bread, your response is to be, that ain't me. Thank you very much. Get it? But it's all accomplished because of the work of this Christ, who deserves all honor and glory and praise.